U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The White House warns about a very tough 2 weeks ahead, and President Trump calls for a $2 trillion infrastructure package. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal, sitting in today for Paul Jagot. We are joined by my colleagues Kim Strassel. Hello, Kim.
Hi, Kyle.
And Bill McGurn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Kyle.
So during the coronavirus press briefing on Tuesday night, President Trump was solemn, might be the word for it. I'll read a few fragments of his opening remarks. Our country is in the midst of a great national trial. Success in this fight will require the full, absolute measure of our collective strength, love, and devotion. Every citizen is being called upon to make sacrifices. Every business is being asked to fulfill its patriotic duty. I want every American to be prepared for the hard days that lie ahead. Kim, that seems like a more subdued tone than we're used to hearing.
Yeah, and certainly a more subdued tone than last week when the president said, look, I'd really like this to be over by Easter and we're going to open up again. And he was quite honest with what changed that tone, which was that the scientific advisors presented him with a lot of very disturbing evidence about where exactly we are right now in this curve flattening exercise we're doing, and the fact that it simply was going to take longer time for the country to get back to a place where it could go back to business. And they presented those numbers. We got some of those yesterday too, which was very heartening to sort of just see that they know, they seem to know what's going on, that there is some sort of plan. But he was very, very open with the fact that we are in the middle of this and there's going to be a rough couple of weeks coming up.
The health experts, as you said, they gave an explanation of the modeling that they've been showing to the president. They showed him a bunch of it over the weekend as he was extending those social distancing guidelines to April 30th. The headline number yesterday being that the virus may kill 100,000 to 240,000 Americans in the health experts' best estimate at this point. One of the slides that grabbed me, Bill, was from Deborah Birx, the coronavirus response coordinator, and it showed a line graph of the number of cases in all 50 states, with New Jersey far above the rest, as you might expect just hearing the numbers in the news. New York far above the rest, and then New Jersey about halfway down, and then everybody else clustered below that. And her point was that you need to keep the rest of the states from turning into New York, which means staying home even if it doesn't look like there's a crisis in your state at any given moment.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because one of the things in looking at the measures, I'm looking at statistics collected by the International Health Metrics and Evaluation Center at the University of Washington. And they do a state-by-state breakdown that's very helpful with graphs. And one of the things they show, it parallels what you said, the chart that Dr. Birx had. They show that they're expecting April 10th to be the peak day for deaths in New York, 845 they're projecting on that date. And after that date, it'll go down. For New Jersey, it's April 9th. So the hope is that that we can flatten the curve here to flatten it elsewhere. But I think that that's important for another reason. I think one of the frustrations for people is we're doing all these different things. A lot of states are taking different measures. Different countries are taking different measures. And since we're on the left side of that curve, all we see is deaths climbing, no matter what steps we take. I think if it does peak, if people start seeing it actually coming down, that we're on the downslope, even though there'll still be a lot of people that die and a lot of people that get infected, I think people will be a little more encouraged by the steps we have to take. And I go back to, we might be a little more able to refine the steps we take, who we apply it to. Right now, we're kind of doing the one size fits all program of, you know, everyone sort of stay in place and not work. But once we're sort of on the downslope, I think we might be able to do more with testing and tracing to figure out who's immune, who might get back to work, what kind of industries might go back and so forth, and be a little more refined. And I think people would see this is not unendable, you know, that we're, again, making progress. And I think people would be more open to some of the measures if they thought it was really having an effect.
I think that's a fair point. So even the hopeful news out of Tuesday's briefing doesn't seem to have any specific targets on it. So there was a slide that Dr. Anthony Fauci discussed where he's showing the curve in Italy is starting to turn down now that they're 3 or 4 weeks into their mitigation measures. And he says there's little inklings that the mitigation is working in New York. But there doesn't seem to be a hard target or of any kind yet, at least not that I'm seeing that's being laid out by the White House. And there are a lot of people who are not in New York and are a lot farther from the crisis zones. One point to talk about was we mentioned yesterday the American Enterprise Institute report written by several health experts. One of them being Scott Gottlieb, the former FDA head of the FDA. And he suggests some triggers which maybe would be helpful. One of them being that, you know, once you have sustained reduction in cases for 14 days, then that might be a trigger to ease off the distancing, on a state by state, region by region basis. Kim, do you think it would be useful to have, if the White House laid out some kind of targets like that people could look toward?
So, yeah, I don't think there's any question that that's going to have to be the way forward, despite the fact that we have these news cable stations that are constantly showing us cumulative numbers of cases and cumulative numbers of deaths. This has always been happening on a state-by-state basis. And if you look at that report that you mentioned, Kyle, they talked about a trigger of having a sustained reduction in cases for 14 days, but also pointing out that a state's going to also need to have the capability in place to test everyone with symptoms and to very aggressively jump on anyone who was found to have them and who tests positive to go to their contacts and kind of lock this down so that it doesn't get back out of control again. And the report even says that it could well be the case that even if a state begins to relax social distancing measures, if they see a spike again, they might have to return to them. So this is going to be kind of state by state on a case by case basis. It's not necessarily going to be one day you flip a switch and the nation's back on.
But it would be helpful to get some of this information out of not only think tanks, but out of, the leaders who are in charge of managing this crisis. Just give people a sense of what the next step is. One sign of the times, I saw this as a news item. I thought it was interesting. Walmart has announced that it's going to be doing temperature checks on all of its employees when they report to stores or distribution centers. That's a huge move. Walmart, I believe, is the United States' largest employer. About 1.5 million people work there. Bill, is that a taste of what the new normal may look like, at least until we potentially have a vaccine for this virus?
Yeah, I think it's one of many steps. I think right now we've taken a kind of one-size-fits-all approach, you know, imposing the lockdown and keeping everyone for work. And obviously the smarter solution is going to be able to discriminate, to identify who's a carrier, who's immune, and so forth. It was interesting. I was talking to a friend from Hong Kong yesterday, where I lived for 10 years. You know, very modern place. They had a tough time with SARS, years ago. So they don't have a lockdown. Now, they've banned school, they've closed schools and big religious services and other big gatherings, but they're closer to social distancing, and they're using that in public spaces as well. So instead of locking everyone down, telling them they can't work, they're putting it out in public space. They're doing, you just mentioned the temperature. In a lot of big buildings, they have these things, kind of like you walk through the airport, that scans you for temperature, right? It's not the be-all and end-all, but I think it's something like 90% of people that have a temperature. So that's one way of doing it. They're also doing social distancing in the public square. So again, rather than closing down restaurants, you go to a restaurant, it'll be open and you can sit there, but there'll be a table or two between you and the next party. So I think as we have more information, we might be able to do that. I think right now, looking at the models and looking at the peaks for New York and New Jersey, which again are just about a week out, I think the president is preparing us for some really bad times. Like before we can get to that point, we're going to have to still climb up that hill, and it's going to be brutal. But I think it might look very different after 2 weeks if people start seeing that in the two worst cases, New York and New Jersey, that we've arrested the increase and it's starting to go down.
Yeah, that's true. And the temperature checks aren't a surefire thing. I mean, the heads of the Centers for Disease Control is now saying that, you know, maybe up to 25% of the people who have this coronavirus may not be showing symptoms, which is part of what makes it unusual and particularly liable to spread. But you could still catch 75% maybe of people and stop them from interacting at a pretty low cost of some thermometers. We're talking about the coronavirus fight and the new talk of a federal building spree. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
We talked on the last podcast about Nancy Pelosi's push for a fourth coronavirus relief bill from Congress and her idea of getting some significant infrastructure spending in it. President Trump has now endorsed that in theory. He tweeted, with interest rates for the United States being at zero, this is the time to do our decades-long awaited infrastructure bill. It should be very big and bold, all capital letters, $2 trillion, and focus solely on jobs and rebuilding the once great infrastructure of our country. Kim, Trump is a builder, and so this has always been the kind of thing that appeals to him, and he has huddled with Democrats on infrastructure in the past. I think last year there was talk maybe of doing this. Why has it broken down previously, and will this be any different?
Well, this has always been the great hope, right? Because this is the one area where everybody agrees, in theory. Trump loves to build things. Democrats love to spend money. And it's never worked out in the past because their disdain for the president has been so much that they didn't want to give him a victory or work with him on anything. So from my perspective, the risk here, because by the way, I think this is a terrible idea, but the risk here is that we now have a new vehicle for working together, right? Which is a response to coronavirus. And Nancy Pelosi is positioning this as a stimulus. The president is positioning this as a stimulus. I think one problem though, and you're going to see that kind of clash as this debate goes forward, is that Nancy Pelosi's idea of stimulus is to give a lot of money to school teachers, okay? Donald Trump made clear in his tweet that he sent out about this, it needs to be, you know, focused on the economy and building. That's broken down in the past, too, as well, because of those very divergent visions of what an infrastructure bill looks like. That could still be a hurdle for anyone to get over.
But even if you grant Trump his vision of it, that this would be bridges and roads and ports and dams and dredging and stuff like that, it's hard for me to see how this is going to be a stimulus during the coronavirus pandemic bill. I mean, how wasn't this the problem with the Obama stimulus during the financial crisis? It was shovel ready. That wasn't shovel ready. I mean, Bill, how fast could this money possibly get anywhere near the actual economy?
Yeah, well, I think as Kim sort of suggested, you know, we learned that the definition of shovel ready was that it goes to teachers' pay and pensions and so forth. Look, again, I think Kim and I are on the same wavelength here. I don't think it's just not going to help in coronavirus. I think it's kind of a dubious idea in itself, and especially for our economy now. I don't see how this solves the problem that we have. I mean, the problem we have is that we've stopped a lot of production. because of this. So there's a lot of demand. There just isn't the supply. I don't really know what this does, because once some of those steps are lifted, I think there's going to be a lot of pent-up demand satisfied. There's going to be a lot of gearing up on the economy. And I dissent from the idea also that bold equals more dollars. You know, when I worked in a White House, people would say that sometimes, you know, we need a big ticket thing, no small beer. And that always got me very nervous, because I think we have very few examples where that's worked.
Just to pick out one example, though, of why this will take so long to get through, let's talk a little bit about NEPA, the National Environmental Protection Act, which the Journal has written a good amount over the years. So that's the law that requires these environmental studies of new infrastructure projects like roads. So there's a study of that in the White House that said that the average final environmental impact statement from 2013 to 2017 took 4 years and ran 670 pages. And remember, that's an average, so there are some really wild outliers, like an expansion of an interstate, 12 miles of an interstate that took like 9,000 pages or something like that. So in January, the Trump administration has proposed a rule that would streamline this a little bit and put a presumptive limit on those impact statements of 2 years and 300 pages. But that rule, I don't think, Kim, that rule, I don't think that's finalized yet. And so that could help. But still, I mean, you're still talking about 2 years before any of this money would potentially be put into the road.
Yeah, it's not finalized. And it's also, because it's an executive order or a rule, it's not necessarily a true reform. And that's one of the other problems with this whole debate and discussion, is that it's the rest of the Republican Party and the rest of the Democratic Party, too, not just Nancy Pelosi and Trump. And there's long been an understanding among Republicans that they have a price if there's going to be public money spent on infrastructure, right? Because you're going to have some people say, oh, you know, this is just something we'll put a little bit of seed money and we'll leverage private sector dollars to do these things. But the reality is, you're going to have to put a bunch of government money in to do this. And Republicans have always said, Democrats, if you want us to do that and commit this money to it, you're going to have to allow for regulatory reform so that these projects can get done at, like, off the ground and get moving within a matter of months. And because the environmental left basically controls the Democratic Party, that's always been a place Democrats won't go. So you still have that fundamental problem there, in that it's maybe Donald Trump could push his party to go along with this, but there is going to be an enormous amount of Republican skepticism to a move like this if there wasn't some fundamental change in the law.
Yeah, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is already playing this down a little bit, saying that, you know, we need to wait and see how the last stimulus bill went before we do anything else. So, you know, maybe this will end up as another Donald Trump tweet and nothing more, but we'll have to wait and see. Let's talk a little bit now about Joe Biden, who is still stuck at home, but trying to get his message out. So he has launched a new podcast called Here's the Deal with Joe Biden. And he does seem to be shifting his own tone a little bit. So he put out a 2 or 3 minute web advertisement where he's lauding healthcare workers as American heroes, cut with images, video of people in face masks and ambulance crews and that kind of thing. Bill, I mean, do you think this is a better tack for him right now than attacking the president, which is what he had been doing previously?
I do, but I still think he's in kind of a bad position. Look, he's in the position sort of the person who's selected to give the rebuttal address after the State of the Union. I mean, you have the President of the United States speaking from the podium of Congress with all three branches of government represented. There's no more powerful image. And then the poor guy that's stuck rebutting just looks small by comparison. And the former vice president stuck in his basement, you know, with this confusing equipment that he can't master. I think it's a better tone, but it's a difficult time for him, because whether or not you like Donald Trump or agree with him, what the American people see is a president taking command and so forth. And it's very hard to counter that. I do think if he wanted to be noticed, it'd be less to berate Trump. I don't think the American people are in a mood for just carping and about people who are trying to do something, even if they're wrong about some of it. I do think he could show his leadership within the Democratic Party by calling the Democratic Congress to better behavior and more cooperation and so forth. Say this is a time to put past the politics and do it. I think that would actually make him look more like a commander in chief. But he's in a very he's in his basement. He's in a very difficult position to command the same kind of respect and attention that the president has. And that has nothing to do with either Joe Biden himself or Donald Trump himself, but just the nature of the position that he's in.
Yeah, and Kim, it's hard to know what else he might be able to do at this point. I mean, if he went out somewhere to Detroit and tried to hold a press conference or something, he'd be charged with breaching the rules of social distancing. And don't forget, he's in the age group that is pretty vulnerable to this virus. So, I mean, what other options does he have?
Well, actually, it was really interesting. He did do something unique and different on Tuesday, which is, I guess, his attempt to continue to try to campaign out in the States, even though he can't officially campaign in the States. But what he did on Tuesday is he actually endorsed a pair of Wisconsin school district referendums, which is highly unusual for someone to be at the kind of national level running as a presidential candidate to bother with something like a school referendum. But these referendums are in Milwaukee, which is Wisconsin's largest school district, and Racine. Both are heavily Democratic districts. These referendums were all about getting more dollars for schools. So the Milwaukee one would cost taxpayers about $87 million. The Racine one has about $1 billion. And his argument was, you know, we need to invest in our public schools and our students. And so I'm supporting these two referendums. So this is his way of trying to get some more headlines within the state, and a state that, by the way, he has not yet been able to campaign in at all. But a state that's going to matter in the Democratic primary races as we go forward. So these are the kind of, I don't know what you would call them, actions that they're having to resort to get their name out, even in the states that have yet to decide on a nominee.
Yeah, unorthodox campaigning. That's interesting. Bill, how do you weigh what the outcomes of that are in play here politically? I mean, what's been interesting to me is that throughout this crisis, President Trump's handling of it has been rated very, very well by voters, and his overall approval rating has been going up a little bit. But it's also notable to me that if you look at the Real Clear Politics averaging of polls on the general election, Trump versus Biden, I mean, I know it's early, but Biden's not doing too bad. He's currently up in the average by about 6 points. I mean, what do you make of that, those numbers moving not in tandem?
Yeah, I don't really make anything of the latter, because until a campaign starts, I think you see a lot of that. I remember the polls about Hillary Clinton saying kind of the same thing. It's very abstract until Donald Trump, the campaign really begins, and Donald Trump and the RNC, everyone gets in full gear, and the Democrats get in full gear to attack. On the ratings of the press conference, I think the president has moved a lot from his initial things. It's one thing about Donald Trump. If you put aside the noise that always accompanies him and just focus on what he does, he often adjusts. Now, he'll never admit it, right? He'll never admit he changed his mind or something. I mean, I think it's fair to say that he downplayed the virus in the beginning. I don't think he downplayed it because he was saying it was not serious. But again, there were Democrats trying to use it politically against him as though this were the new Russia. But, you know, that's a distinction very hard to make today. But whatever he did in the beginning, that's not what he's doing now. I'm not sure. I can't tell whether his higher ratings for this is because he's been so good at these press conferences or because the media has been so appalling in their frivolous questions, their personal attacks, and their petty obsessions. So it could be just people reacting against what they see of the press corps. So I'm not sure which it is that the president's really upped his game for this, or that the press has just really disgraced itself, or a combination of both.
All right. Well, thank you, Bill. Thank you, Kim. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.